So welcome everyone. Thank you for coming on this Father's Day. Traditionally in cultures or traditions that have a sense of rebirth, reincarnation, again, as most of you know, which is not really a central core to the Buddhist teaching, but certainly has been part of it, primarily, for many reasons. But anyhow, it's not central to practicing the way of the Buddha, but it's a interesting way of looking at things. But if one looked at it that way, we would have to acknowledge that the primary two causal agents for us taking a human birth is our mother and father. And because that is considered something good, to have a human birth, and all the opportunities that human birth offers an individual, traditionally great respect is given to one's mother and father for having provided that to us. And that is really irrespective of how we may look at the quality of the job that they did afterwards. Because it's, from a traditional point of view, it's really not about that. It's one that they provided this wonderful opportunity to us, and that, for better or worse, when we were in our total dependency phase, which means we were infant, toddlers, little children, they took care of us. They made sure we were fed, that we were bathed, that we were kept healthy, that if we were sick, they sought medical care for us. So that generally, it is because of their care and their watching over us that we were able to come into this world and have a life until we were able to, be on our own, so to say. In our society, where there's so much emphasis on the content of the relationship with our mother and father, and that has often, fortunately or unfortunately, for many of us, taken primacy, right, over that the very fact that they gave us life and they took care of us, protected us for many, many years when we weren't able to. There are not too many other people in this world that we can say that about. So for that reason, it's good to honor that aspect. And then obviously, if there were other good things, and hopefully there were, in the kind of care, love, opportunities, whatever, that our parents provided us, so much the better. To increase our love and respect. But again, even if they had, because of their own sufferings and the way they were raised, their capacity to be the parent we wanted them to be may have been limited or compromised significantly, it's still good for us to hold them in respect for their, again, being the two primary causes of our ability to take on this human life. And we wouldn't be here today without that, would we? So, Father's Day comes after Mother's Day. Because mother is the primary agent. Father is the contributing agent. But yet genetically, they are equal. So that's good to remember. Before we return to our formal teachings, as most of you know, we always begin with an opportunity for anyone to ask questions about the meditation practices we do here, that we've done here this evening, or as importantly, more importantly, how we are attempting to bring the teachings of mindfulness, the teachings of Buddhism, the teachings of the basic principles of spirituality into our daily life so we can heal and transform, cease our suffering and the suffering of those around us. Again, which isn't often the most easiest thing to do or the most obvious thing to do. So we need to talk about these things so we really understand how to do it and how to go about it. So if anybody has any questions about the application of mindfulness and Buddhism in their daily life or about the practices of meditation, please feel free to ask any question you want. And please don't be shy. I mean, that's kind of silly. We don't have that many opportunities to meet, and we may never meet again. So, any questions? Just take a moment to reflect on your life and see if there's any area of your life, personal and interpersonal, that is not characterized by harmony and well-being, ease. Yes. One brave soul willing to admit.
This concept of suffering,
mm-hmm.
which I look at for myself, it's not really suffering and not suffering. There's modes of, or degrees as such,
not. Well, again, many of you know that there are about 52 members of our community about to embark on a 10-week intensive on suffering, which actually transforming suffering. For those who are in it, you'll learn this soon, but for those who aren't, I can just say a few words. The question is suffering and the degrees of suffering. And
it's not suffering and not suffering.
But the real interesting thing is that suffering is a translation of a Sanskrit word. And again, for those in the intensive, you'll hear this again. But the Buddha did not say life is suffering, even though everywhere you read it says life is suffering. Buddha never said life is suffering. Suffering is a translation of a word in Sanskrit that is attributed to the Buddha, which is the word is dukkha. D-U-K-K-H-A, which then people translate. And, like many Asian languages, words like in Sanskrit or characters like in Chinese or other languages have multiple meanings and shades of meaning. And when you put it all into one word, you're kind of stuck with that. But dukkha, which the Buddha said, and the Buddha didn't say it in terms of human life. He called it conditioned life, life that is conditioned by causes and effect. He said is characterized actually by three things. One thing is impermanence or ceaseless change. Two is not self, and three is dukkha. Dukkha again encompasses unsatisfactoriness, dissatisfaction, stress, alienation, being ill at ease, suffering, unhappiness, you know what I mean? There's a whole gamut. And the interesting thing about the word dukkha, he did not oppose it to sukha, which means happiness. He didn't say that the object of life is happiness. He said the object of life is cessation of dukkha, which is interesting. And that if this unsatisfactory, this dissatisfaction, this alienation, this sense of separation, this unhappiness, this misery, this stress, this anxiety, this, you know, that's right? Fear, I mean, that's all worry, anger, right? That's all those mind states are dukkha. Okay, so it's important to understand, you know, what that encompasses. It really encompasses everything other than what? Being at ease, being open, being spacious, being comfortable, right? So anything that is less than that, we could say we are entering the world of dukkha. Now again, obviously there is the dukkha of stubbing one's toe. And there is the dukkha of, you know, having some kind of disease, you know, where your whole body's in torment. Right? You know, there is the dukkha of having a bad day. And there is the dukkha of, you know, being in a deep, dark depression. Does that make sense? So, I mean, does that answer your question? So it's...
So the relief of that is going to come incrementally as well?
Overall, the relief, the cessation of, comes incrementally. It doesn't mean along the way there aren't insights, openings, aha moments, moments of little bits of leaps. But overall, yeah, overall, a real transformation comes over time. And why is that? Because each of us carry with us what's called in Buddhism karma, or karma. Yeah, everybody knows that word, very popular. Karma means cause and effect. It means that right now I am carrying with me many, many, many causes. Really, all my experiences, my upbringing, all the things that have conditioned me, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, you know, for my whole life, right? I carry that. Each of us carries our karma. Our karma is produced. It's all the things that have conditioned us. You know what I'm saying? With a, you might say, a lump of clay, right? If you're a potter, a lump of clay is unconditioned. But, you know, after that, you know, anything goes. You can turn it into anything. You can shape it into anything. You can, right? So that amorphous lump of clay over time gets conditioned by how it's used, by all the things that affect it. In the same way, we have been affected by many things. Our parents, our upbringing, our cultural issues, our teachers, then all our experiences, all our interactions, right? Our values. I mean, there are so many things that have conditioned us to be the way we are today. Now, we may come to see, what is your name again? As Candy said, that a lot of this life, a lot of the way we are in life, may be characterized by dukkha, right? So, having said that, the healing and transformation that needs to occur to reach a state where that is none of that is no longer operating, right? That takes time. Because this is what? Strong. We totally identify with this. We say, this is me, right? I'm an angry person. I'm a happy person. I'm an anxious person. I'm a this person. I'm a that person, right? I mean, because we say that because we identify our conditioned self as who we are, right? But a legitimate spiritual path teaches us that's not the case, and that which we think we are, and that, you know, coming back to the clay, right? Anybody ever work with clay? You can, you know, have a nice little thing going there, right? Before it's been fired, and you can take it toward to your teacher, and they may just throw it back down in the slab and turn it back into a bowl and say, start over. Fashion something else. Or they may work it in a certain way to show you quite easily that something that you thought, you know, that was all you were capable of with a few little tweaks and a few of that could become something else, couldn't it? So that which you thought was the finished product was really just a work in progress. That's important to know. So, in a certain sense, we can say that insight, understandings, beliefs can change very quickly, right? Which is true, because they're just thoughts. And thoughts what? Come and go. Thoughts are unstable. Thoughts have no real substance. So, in a certain sense, certain things can be changed fairly easily. But that energy of our conditioning, that thing which propels us, right, that takes a little more time. That's what we work with. That's the clay we work with. And that's good. That's what we're here for, to work with that clay. You know, because maybe that clay face now is not a happy face. It's a sad face, or an anxious face, or a worried face, or an angry face, or a confused face, or a, you know, sad face, right? I mean, that could be the face on that piece of clay. But once one understands that that is not fixed, that hasn't been hardened, that hasn't been baked truly, one understands, oh, I can learn to work with it and make a different kind of face. Yes. What is your name again?
Claudia.
Claudia, that's right.
You mentioned being very identified to a certain personality.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with others in your life that have they've identified with a certain personality of who you are? So how do you deal with, you know, all of a sudden you're changing and you're trying to transform yourself, but others are like, wait, what's going on? You know, who's this person? And what have you done with the normal body? You know what I mean?
So you're talking about people you're very personally involved with.
Yeah, like coworkers.
Yeah, that's not that unusual for people, because you know at this stage of the growth of, let's say, Buddhism and meditation, it's fairly new. So most of us have come to it at our life, at a certain stage of life. We've come to it, as opposed to being born in it. And so that often means that we may be one out of our family or whatever, or coworkers or friends, who are moving to this path, right? I mean, it doesn't mean that there may not be other interests, but that's often the case. Generations from now, that may not be. But that seems to be at least for these couple of generations. So I think there are two things that are important, Claudia, or probably at least two things. One is that the change is primarily inner. So we can't, in other words, we are changing ourselves, our minds, our emotional life, and the way we relate to things. That's primarily what we're doing, right? And that's really what's most important. So as long as we don't put too much stress on the outer trappings, we might have less, we may stand out less. In other words, we don't have to practice this path. We don't have to change our clothes, you know what I mean? Or we don't have to change our haircut. Or, you know what I'm saying? We don't have to necessarily, I mean, we could. I mean, but people do that all the time anyhow. But in other words, we don't have to do those kinds of outer things that may give a sense, oh, she's now a Buddhist or something, you know, wear your Buddhist pin to work or something. So we do less of that. I think another thing is to be just aware of what you said. That in your circle, at this point, you may be the one who's changing. And we can't expect the others to do what we want them to do. Right? And so we have to make sure that we don't become a little obnoxious. You know what I'm saying? because like a lot of time, you know, when we discover something that we think is great or wonderful, we want what? We want to share it with everybody. We want everybody to take advantage of it. And, you know, we think it's the most obvious thing in the world. But you may find out that the rest of the world doesn't see it that way. And so we want, you know, I think to be informative, if people ask, you know, what are you into these days? Or what are you doing? you know, to mention it. But you don't have to give, like, the full explanation. I mean, to me, it might just say a few words. Oh, well, I've been, you know, learning how to meditate or going to a meditation group. And see what they say. You know, if they ask more questions, then you may follow up. But if they give you a look of, oh, that's nice, and then change the subject, you know this is probably not a conversation you want to continue with. You know what I'm saying? So you make sure that we're not causing any rifts or problems by our own action.
It's not really that. It's more, so if you react differently in a certain situation, mm-hmm. and it's very unlike if you've ever reacted before, it's very alarming.
Yeah, I was just about to get there. So if it's not the other case, then what I was going to try to get to, which is, you know, now this is real. So the other stuff I was just sort of saying, we just have to be careful that we're not kind of just unknowingly, you know, because of our enthusiasm or interest, just creating a separation or a rift. But now what you're getting into is that actually you are changing. You are not the Claudia you were 3 months ago. You know what I mean? Or something like that. And that has to be genuine. Right? And that's fine. I mean, you don't have to hide that or be ashamed of that. But I think it's often important, especially if, like, these are people you're very involved with in your life. Sometimes that is anxiety-producing for people. I mean, I've known many couples where it can be like that. You know, one is changing. One is once a week going to something that the other one doesn't know anything about. You know, and worst fears, it's a cult, or you know what I mean? Just kind of a relationship thing. You know, you're doing now something that is different and doesn't include your partner, right? And so that can be anxiety producing. So I think it's often knowing that, I think it's important to really let the anticipate that, and to let the person know that it's not like that, and if anything, this will make me a better person, a kinder person, a more open person. And my experience over time is that's actually what happens, and that if it's handled the right way, that spouse or partner or family member actually over time becomes supportive, because they see you are a better person. You're a kinder person. You're more patient. I even know of families where the spouses or even the children say, "You know, mommy, it's time for you to go meditate. Mom, I think you're kind of losing it." You know, I mean, it's, and then you know it's working because they kind of get that this is something beneficial, and they'll be, you know, "Have you meditated today, mommy?" It's, you know, stuff like that. Okay. But again, I think anticipating that again, that you know, even though this seems, to me this is normal what we do here. This is nothing extraordinary. But for many people, it seems a little far out. And so just anticipate that and just speak to them about, you know, I mean, let them know what you're doing, and you know, and let them know that you know you're doing it so you can be a better Claudia. Right, and you're not doing it to anyway separate them, and they have nothing to worry about. And the other thing is, invite them to come. I mean, invite them to come as an observer. You know, say, you know, why don't you come one? And I've seen that happen a lot. You know, just come once, and you can sit in the back, and you know, and so you just see what it is. You know, just so at least it's not strange or. I don't know how often we do it here, but in a lot of the sanghas. You know, having other kinds of social events like dinners and things like that, or movie nights where people can bring family members who aren't, you know, but it's a kind of a nice meeting place is also good. You know, so people see, oh, they're just normal people. You know? This is not a cult, or these aren't, you know, like that. You know, most of these relationships, right? Family relationships, close friends relationships, have a history. Right? They have a history, and there's probably a very well-worn groove the way people act and interact with each other. And if you are practicing sincerely, you are changing, right? And so in that sense, maybe sometimes it is a test of a relationship. Not a big test. It doesn't have to be a test that breaks anything. But it's a test whether, you know, the relationship can accommodate changes. You know, and that the love and the commitment, et cetera, is strong enough, but also flexible enough. That people can change and yet, you know, still be who they are. And still who they've been. And, you know, and you may tell your family members just to, you know, just to bear with you. You know, that this is new for you and you're experimenting too, but it's all for the good. And you're hoping that this will make you a better spouse, mother, daughter, you know, the whole friend, colleague. Right. But, you know, work is a funny thing because a lot of times, you know, I'm sure people who know work, you know, you hang out in the lunchtime and a lot of it is what? I mean, in the lunch hour, you know, a lot of it is what?
Gossip.
Yeah, complaints, 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 gossip, gossip, gossip. You know, I mean, it's kind of normal. And a lot of times, as you begin to practice, you are less, you are not interested in communicating that much that way anymore, as well as you're less interested in hearing it. And so, you know, but that's good. I mean, I certainly encourage people, I mean, not to be obnoxious. But, you know, I mean, like there's some work situations where it's just very negative, you know. People are always talking bad about each other and gossiping and backbiting. And it's really wonderful, you know, when somebody's going on about, you know, just to point out their positive qualities. You know, that kind of is a conversation changer. Or to go, well, maybe, you know, this is the reason, you know, look for causes. You know, try to be understanding. So in other words, right? Or just change the subject, you know? I mean, a lot of that kind of gossip and backbiting and talking negatively, I mean, don't forget. I mean, my sense, having worked for many years in the situation is, I assure you, if they're talking negatively about somebody else when you're not around, they're probably doing the same about you. I mean, that just kind of, people tell you who they are, right? So, you know, I mean, you know, again, you don't have to put people down, but when people talk that way, you just don't have to respond, which just feeds it. You know, and just, okay, and, you know, ask them about something else or change the subject. I think over time, people begin to learn what? That you're not interested in that kind of communication. One, you don't do it, and two, you're not interested in hearing it. And again, you don't, I mean, I guess if it was really quite terrible, you know, the way they're talking, you could say to somebody, you know, I really, you know, I don't want to have this conversation. There's no need. This is not helpful, right? Or, you know, I mean, well, what I used to do for years, when people would start talking about so and so, my first response would be, well, I think you should share that with them. You know, why are you telling me? Why don't you tell them? Right? I think it's a good point. Why don't you go tell them? I mean, that shuts them right up. Right? Because they don't really want to tell that person. You know, if you have a problem with that person, why are you telling me? Why don't you go talk to them and straighten it out? Or would you like me to sit down with the two of you and work it out? Quiet. Because again, they don't want to work it out. And again, it's not like, you know, our complaining colleagues or our gossiping are bad people. You know what I'm saying? They just don't know better because it's just normal. You know, a lot of work environments are fairly toxic environments in the way people relate to each other. And they just, you know, that's the culture, right? That's often the culture of the workplace. Not everybody works in a workplace where everybody is very supportive and kind and understanding, supportive. I mean, does anybody work in a workplace like that? Yeah, I mean, that's unusual, right? I mean, hold on. How many people raise their hand? So how many people work in a kind, supportive, where everybody's very understanding, supportive of each other? Right, how many? Yeah, a few. And how many people work where it's not that? Yeah, so people, so you can see how fortunate you are. But again, for those who don't, it doesn't mean that you cannot contribute. You know, we talk about wanting to change the world, right? And make it a better place. Most probably everybody in here wants to. But how about our workplace, you know, for starters? And again, it doesn't mean, you know, to go in there with placards and signs, and but it means that we just kind of change the way we are. That we really are attentive to our own communication, to make sure that our communications is always supportive, right, helpful, kind, problem-solving, clear, and that when that other kind of communication goes on, you know, we deal with it in a different way, in the way you're changing. And you know, I think you can make a difference. If not, they'll just leave you alone. You know, people, you know, when people are caught, aren't they? They're caught in patterns that they're just habituated to. And usually when systems are like that, have their own kind of energy, when someone is beginning to step out of that, the system initially really wants what? To bring them in. To bring them back in. That's the nature of systems. Right? But, you know, if you are clever enough, and if you know what's going on, you can begin to change the system, the energy of the system, because you are no longer participating in it. And if you start putting in a different kind of energy, and whether this is in your one-on-one relationships, your extended family relationships, your work relationships, and all those kind of relationships, you can begin to change. Right? You know, there are many people who are very good people, they have good values, they want a better world, they want to change the world, they give to good causes, but they overlook, you know, the immediacy of their personal life, their family life, their work life, you know. I mean, that's a good place to start, right? If we want to change the world. Why don't we start with our own small little world and see whether we can make a difference there? Many of us, you know, we like working on the grand scale of things. But the very intimate, personal, interpersonal is in a certain way more difficult, isn't it? Because we don't want to acknowledge how enmeshed we are in that way of doing things. So please experiment with your significant relationships, parents, children, friends, work colleagues. You know, in Buddhism, in terms of initiating change, there are two criteria. One is appropriateness and the other one is skillfulness. I mean, bigger than that is kind of a wisdom and a clarity and a compassion, right? That propels one wanting to make a difference, wanting to make a change in something. But then when it comes to action, right? And that's where many of us have problems, right? You know, we mean well, but often our actions are not very skillful. Skillful in the sense is they don't really produce the change we want. So in Buddhism, we say, that in the world of actions, we need to be, I mean, underpinning them is this compassion, clarity, and understanding of things. But then when we act firstly, is my action appropriate for the person or the situation? Right? In other words, the way I interact or act with a five-year-old, it may be different than it may be the same problem, but how I act with a five-year-old, a 15-year-old, a 25-year-old, and a 65-year-old, right? May be very different because of who, you know, of where they are developmentally, right? So in the same way, people and their worldview, their cultural view, their personal issues, you know, we want to make sure that whatever we're trying to do to help is appropriate for that person. Is that clear? Right. Which means, see, many people, when they're trying to help somebody, it's all about what? Me. You know, I want to help them to be who I want them to be, or I want to change the situation so it is the way I think it should be. You know, that means it's what? It's all about me, right? But if I'm really seeing them and understanding them and where they're at, the intervention that I do may be very different than what I want to do, because I want it to be appropriate for them. Why is that? So they'll be interested, right? So they'll kind of get it. See, I'm not just trying to be right. I'm trying to be helpful. Being right and being helpful are often two different things. To be helpful means I'm helping that other person. To be right means I'm really just doing it my way because it's really all about me. Is that clear? Even when we're trying to, even when we're motivated by good reasons. So we want our actions to be appropriate to the person in the situation and to where they're at and how they see things. And then we want it to be skillful. You know, that it works. You know, to find the right words, to find the right action. Right. And of course you understand that. I mean, this is very, I mean, there's nothing I'm saying now that's not popular these days, right? So we know if someone is a you know, the whole issue of codependency and all that stuff and dependency, you know, if we are trying to, you know, for somebody else, being there for them, helping them out, being supportive of them, may be a good deed. But if there is someone who doesn't have a lot of independence and really doubts their own capacity to be an effective human being and to act independently and make their own decisions, then a lot of that stuff that may be very nice and helpful for this person over here may be not very nice or helpful for this person here. It's not appropriate, as well as in my action, I may not be that skillful. Is that, do people understand when you get the distinction there? Right? So if your friend asks you, can you pick up a bottle of wine on the way over? And you say, sure. If that person's an alcoholic, that may not be the nicest gesture you can do for them. Right? Outwardly it may seem that way, but it may not be appropriate. Why? Because you want to help this person come out of their addiction, not facilitate it. Right? So if you know someone who has not a lot of experience with making their own decisions and being self-efficacious and always leans on others, so when they call you up and say, oh my God, you know, everything's falling apart, can you come over here and help me? You might say to them what? Relax. Give yourself time. You can figure it out. Now, for somebody else, another friend of yours, they may go, gee, I thought you were my friend. You see? And it may be fine to go over and help them. But in another situation, it may not be. It may actually be harmful. Not harmful in a dramatic way, but harmful in terms of helping that person grow up. Right? So those of you who've had children, you know, oftentimes you have to what? Not do things for them so they can what? Grow up. Take responsibility. And that often implies what? Making mistakes. Falling on their face. And just running over there and picking them up and doing everything for them may not be appropriately, you know, and skillful. It may actually be doing harm. So again, I mean, it's, you can see helping is often not that easy. I mean, in a certain sense, it's easy because we have good hearts. But to really help someone and to really see how they need to be helped, it takes some understanding, some clarity. Is that clear? So always being kind, always being helpful, always being there may not always be the best way to be. On the other hand, to have an attitude like, hey, everybody's responsible for their own mess, right? You made it, you clean it up. Right? I mean, that may not also be the best way to build a relationship and friendship too, right? Because we want to be there and help each other. But if there's someone who lives a life where their expectation is I go out and make messes and your job is to clean up after me, giving them that message may be the most kind thing you can do for them. It's your mess, you clean it up. Now that may sound what? A little harsh, a little cruel, a little heartless. But I might say, no, it's the kindest thing you can do for that person. Because maybe you want to give them the message, you know, you can do this. And you don't have to keep making messes. You know? And as long as I clean up your mess, you'll never have to learn how to live life without making messes. I'm kind of going off, but I'm just trying to I'm just trying to say skillfulness and appropriateness in helping is creative. You know, to really, before we jump into a situation, just to say, you know, what really is going on here? And what really is the most beneficial way I can help this person? Again, for a three-year-old, you may tie their shoes, right? But you may not want to tie your five-year-old's shoe. Why not? Because they can do it themselves, can't they? And you want to give them the message, you can do it. You keep tying their shoes, then what? You're giving them the message, what? You can't do this. You need me to do it. Any other questions about practice in daily life? Yes.
You know that Buddhism and most religions speak of compassion.
In Buddhism and most religions teach compassion. Yes. Is that that's a statement you're making. Okay.
But I have problems with compassion. And I'm
you're a brave woman to admit it.
I feel very close to the people who I know and I love, even my circle.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy for
them. Mm-hmm.
People I don't know, I usually have an initial anti-reaction. I usually have a negative reaction. And even some people I know, when I see them again, I have a negative reaction. And I have to, you know, bring them back.
So what is your name again?
Mary.
Mary, and when you say you have a negative reaction, I mean, what actually does that mean, Mary?
I feel like it's strange, maybe critical, judgmental, distant, threatened.
So I hear Alex saying, all right, so Mary's question is, let me just see if I get it right. That compassion, there's compassion in Buddhism, most religion teaches compassion, but you have a problem with compassion. You say that you don't seem to have a problem with people in your circle being compassionate toward them, but people outside your circle, you tend to be standoffish, judgmental, critical, not very compassionate, etc.
Yeah, just a reflex.
As a reflex. Okay. And sort of that's where you are.
Yeah. Okay. I haven't been able to make very much progress with that.
Good. But you want to.
Oh, I think it would be wonderful.
Good.
It would be the answer.
Yeah.
I don't think I have... Everyone's screaming. That's a lot of other issues. This is like my number one.
Well, that's a big one. Yeah, I'm happy you brought it up. Yeah, so.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah. So Buddhism is often called the path of wisdom and compassion, right? Meaning they are equal. that one is cultivating through one's meditations, through one's deep looking, through one's study, etc., a wisdom about life, the mind, the thing, right? And yet, at the same time, in our interactions with the world, we want it to be based on compassion. So we begin where you are, right? And that's very normal, Mary. Right? Where for most of us, what?
I said, oh, I know.
Yeah, yeah. So right. So that's, you know, I mean, that's where we begin. Most of us begin, you know, I mean, at our. Many of us just begin, you know, we're totally narcissistic, right? The only person we really have compassion for and really whose suffering we care about is our own, right? But if those of us who've overcome our childhood narcissism, we may extend it out. But we extend it out. There may be a few others, you know, we'll include our immediate family, maybe we'll include our extended family, our friends, you know what I'm saying? Sometimes people go out a little further, they may extend it to their religious group, their ethnic group, right? But most people don't go too far. And that's where we begin. We begin in the world of self, right? And self, we know, is concerned mainly about one thing. What? It wants to eliminate its own suffering and it wants to increase its own happiness. So it's a fairly, we could say, self-oriented life. That doesn't really look too much beyond its own little world, right? And like you say, the rest of the world out there, we're either indifferent to or we're negative toward. And that's where we begin. So on the heart side of things, in Buddhism, they're called the four measurables. Or often told the four, they're often translated as the four aspects of love, according to the Buddhist teachings. The first of these, before compassion, is metta. Metta means friendliness, friendship. And so what that means is all those qualities, right, that naturally occur in good friendship, which is what? We care about our friends, we're supportive of our friends, we're happy when, you know, when we see them, we smile, we want good things to happen to them, we don't want bad things to happen to them, right? You know, that's friendship. So the first thing we want to do, Mary, is begin to break down. And again, there are teachings and practices and meditations to do this. To begin to extend this metta, this loving kindness, further out than our immediate circle. And we can actually practice it. We do this practice in meditation, where we actually practice sending our loving kindness out beyond our immediate circle, right, that we do naturally for, and to begin to send it out to people that we're neutral to, indifferent to, and also to people that we dislike. And there are actually kind of reflective meditations that help us break down this way we separate ourselves from people, right? Because many of us may have friends, right? May have friends that at one time that we were indifferent to. Right? I'm sure many people here have friends now that they weren't friendly with their whole life. That at some time this was somebody that they were indifferent to, they passed on the street, didn't give them a second look. And that if somebody said, so-and-so, this bad thing happened to so-and-so, you say, oh, that's too bad, but you really don't care. You're indifferent. So we have to realize that why are we friendly toward certain people? well, mostly because of circumstances have brought us together with them, right? And many of these people, again, or all of them, we were indifferent to. We were neutral to before we became friends with them. Right? As well as, can you think of anybody in your life that you were one time friends with that now you're not friends with? But now you're indifferent to, neutral? You haven't thought about him in years. You haven't cared about what happened to him in years. As well as, have you ever had anybody that you were friendly with that then you became enemies with or disliked? Yes. Is there anybody you've ever loved that you've grown to hate? Or anybody you've hated you've grown to love? So we begin to see the kind of the mechanism for how we divide up this world into those we like, those we don't like, and most of which those we're indifferent to. And we learn to see how those artificial barriers are created and then learn how to send loving kindness to everyone. And if we can think of an ideal, it would be what? That we would greet every human being. Every human being. With friendliness. Right? Whether it's somebody who waits us in a store or somebody we bump into or sit down, it doesn't mean we embrace them like they're our best friend. It doesn't mean we love them. But it means we extend friendship to them. That we have some minimal level of caring for everyone. Because again, you know, the example I always use is, you're driving down a one-way street going the right way, and all of a sudden you see a car coming the other way, going the wrong way in a one-way street, right? And they're coming closer to you. Now, what's going on in your head about this person? What are you thinking, Rick, as you see this idiot driving?
Get out of the way.
Yeah, but you also have a way of thinking. That's
something's wrong.
Yeah, that I can't believe that idiot or something, or just think, you know, there's somebody cut you off in traffic or, you know, did something like that, right? And don't you look over and it's your best friend. Right? What happens all of a sudden to all this negative that you just had toward this person? What happens? What?
Immediately disappears.
And you immediately become understanding or concerned, right? Now, all of a sudden, we extend that to this person who, if they weren't your friend, we would think they were a complete idiot, right? We would be enraged at them, right? I mean, let's say they actually ran into you. I mean, right? I mean, I know Rick, he'd be out of the car in a minute with his crowbar ready for blood.
I'd be calling my lawyer.
Right. Right? Raging. And then all of a sudden he saw it was his best friend or his child. Right? What would immediately happen? Change, yeah. Why? The person did the same exact thing. The action is the same. Because all of a sudden we what? We extend friendship. You know, why don't we extend it to everyone? At least see everybody as at least second cousins. Right? Yes.
I used to have similar experiences to hers and still do from time to time.
Uh-huh.
The one thing that I found was oftentimes what would be irritating to me in other people were aspects of myself that like I didn't want to acknowledge at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So if I thought, you know, someone was being really loud and obnoxious and I wanted to shun them because I wasn't, and that my friend, then I find myself like later that night with my friends and I'm being loud and annoying.
Yeah.
Or,
well, that's, yeah.
Yeah, I find that like often. So to notice that and being able to see that that's actually an aspect of yourself that maybe you're not wanting to acknowledge can then cause you to go further inward and then not be so perturbed by
So I'm just for the recording. Yeah, so somebody's just commenting that a lot of times they find historically that a lot of the things that annoy them in other people are actually things, same characteristics or behaviors that they have in themselves and just don't acknowledge. But even on a simpler, less deeper level, we could say that many of the things that annoy us in other people, we clearly do. And we have been guilty of in the past, and you know. But again, you know, it's always interesting. You know, our self-centered world, right? I mean, in my self-centered world, I would like everybody around me to be what? No. No, actually. Actually, that's not the case. But in my most self-centered world, I would like everybody to be what? Totally understanding of me, right? To understand I'm always, I mean well, and right? Wouldn't we? And I'd be supportive. Now, did it ever strike you that everybody else wants the same thing? So why don't we give that to everybody else? And so, the first thing is to begin to generate metta, loving kindness, friendship, to all people. And to really be willing to look more deeply at these projections, at these judgments, at these, you know, why do I wall these people off? I mean, why don't I see, you know, the Dalai Lama, you know, he can't give a talk without saying the most obvious things, which is what? Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. Everybody wants themselves and the people they love to do well, right? And nobody, you know, and not to suffer. In that way, we're all the same, right? We're all the same. And when we acknowledge that and live in that, you know, things become very different how we view other people. We view them as no different than us. Again, it doesn't mean everybody is our best friend. It doesn't mean you want to hang out with everybody, right? But there are people in your own personal family you don't want to hang out with, really, if you had a choice, right? Right? Brian knows that. Right? But yet we what? How do you tolerate some of these obnoxious people in your family? How do you tolerate people in your family who, in the world of choice, you wouldn't choose to be friends with, right? And yet, when they're your family, what do you extend to them?
Slack.
You slack, right? Slack, but slack means what?
Compassion.
Yeah, openness, and you were accepting of them. Yeah. You give them slack, right? Yeah, they are. I mean, right? You know, they are who they are. You know, God love them. They are who they are. Which all of a sudden, what? Allows us to kind of include them in our universe without, right? Yeah, that's just Uncle George. He's always a pain in the woody, you know. Yeah, that's him. He's got that lousy sense of humor. You know what I'm saying? It's like that, right? But we have ways of working with these people that aren't so judgmental, right? So why don't we extend that to everyone at a minimum? So that's loving kindness. That's friendship. The second one, in Buddhism, compassion, which means, which the word is karuna, it actually is an interesting word. It doesn't mean empathy. It means wanting to free somebody from their suffering. Now, obviously, the empathy has to come first because you have to, be in touch with someone's suffering. But it's an active. It's not just empathic. So compassion means I want to help people be free of their suffering. And there are, again, meditations in the meditative tradition to help one learn how to do that more. But first you begin with loving kindness. I mean, first you got to, you know, kind of at least, you know, make everybody, at least if they're not your brother and sister, or at least if they're not your first cousin, second, or at least third cousins, right? Because again, you know, if Claudia, now Claudia and Mary, are you guys basically strangers to each other? Right? I mean, can I, basic Claudia, you've never given a thought to Mary's happiness or her suffering, ever, have you? Right. But I mean, in the general course of things, right? I mean, you're indifferent to Mary and her life and her happinesses, right? And Mary, the same about Claudia, right? In your life.
I heard her speak. So.
Right, but I'm saying generally, you.
See, there's somebody else.
You're right. But generally, you're indifferent to her. But if all of a sudden you talked afterwards and you began, blah, 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 and all of a sudden you realize that you were third cousins, let's say.
Fred, I'm already there for Claudia. Yeah. We have to pick somebody else.
Well, I want you to be more there for her than you have. Remember, we're working on this, Mary.
Come on, quick study.
All right, but can you see that even just saying those words, they're just words, all of a sudden we change. Right? Oh, wow. You're my second cousin. And all of a sudden it's like what? We are now what? Family. Now what's changed? Nothing's changed other than your mind, the way you are perceiving that person, you put a different label on them. And all of a sudden your heart goes out to them. Why? Because you've just changed the label. So again, what we do is, you know, because of the way we've been raised and conditioned, all that, we have this very narrow world. You know, these are the people I love. These are the people I offer friendship to. These are the people I offer compassion to, right? And it's very narrow. But there's nothing preventing us from opening that up. Right? I mean, the human heart, you know, have you ever seen children, or how about animals? You ever seen puppies? Puppies open their heart to what? Everything that moves. Right? I mean, they will just wag their tail and lick and jump on you like what? I mean, they don't know a damn thing about you. They don't know if you're a good person, a bad person, a kind person, unkind, a rich person, a poor person. I mean, right? And they'll just what? They're just happy to see you. Now, how do they do that? That's a very highly developed, right? I mean, if we thought a human being that could offer that kind of love and happiness and joy to every encounter, we would consider that what? A saintly being, right? I mean, and you know, any puppy is capable of that. Right? Hasn't meditated, hasn't studied Dharma, you know, I mean, they can just offer that open-heartedness, right? Why is that? Because they don't label the world. They trust, they're open, right? I mean, if somebody kicked them, then they might what? You know, stay away from that person. Right? But it doesn't mean they won't offer it to the next person. So the human heart is like that. It wants to open. But we've just learned to close it, right? That's all. And in the same way we're learning to train our minds in mindfulness and concentration and deep looking, right? You know, a lot of the practice is about these parts of training our mind. We also have to retrain our heart, because our hearts and minds have been constricted and twisted together, right? So learning to offer loving kindness to people, and learning how to offer compassion to people is what we have to practice. The third one is mudita. Mudita means, this is a great one. It's often translated as taking joy in the joy of others. It means, it's the opposite of envy and jealousy. It means, you know, if you're happy, I'm happy. Right? It's not like, you know, I'm only happy if you do things that I want you to do. You know that one? Right. I am happy when you're doing what I want. I am happy when you're living the way I want you to live. I'm happy when you're succeeding at things that I think you should succeed at, and when you're doing things that I think you shouldn't succeed at, I am not happy. Right? That's not a very open kind of relationship to others. It also means that when I hear about somebody else's good fortune, I'm happy. I don't think, why not me? You know, how come good things only happen to them? Why didn't it happen to me? Right? You see how selfish, focused on myself I am, rather than going, oh, how wonderful the good things are happening to them. That they got this, or they succeeded there, or this thing happened in their life. I'm happy that they're happy. Right? There's no jealousy. There's no envy. You know, Why didn't I get the job? Why didn't I get the raise? Why is he the center of attraction? Right? How come not everybody's paying attention to me? Right? I'm a nicer guy than that one. I'm smarter, I'm more, right? Can you see that's how narrow that is? Yeah, how happy. Isn't that wonderful? Center of attention, I hope he's happy. So that kind of open-heartedness is the third aspect, mudita. And then the fourth is upeda, which is it means different things, but it means sort of equality, equanimity, which again means it relates to the first three, and it says, I give them all out equally. I don't pick and choose. I give to this one, but I don't give to that one. I choose. Right? I choose who I'm offer friendship to. They have to meet very strict criteria. Right? I choose who I offer compassion. Very strict criteria. But you know, if you really love somebody, if you really care about somebody, you will find that loving kindness, compassion, and joy in the joy of others are all naturally there. Right? Are all naturally there. You don't have to do anything. Because that is the natural function of the open heart. There's nothing you have to do. The reason we don't extend it to everyone is because we've twisted. Our mind has twisted our hearts, so it's become narrow. It's become scared. It's become walled off. It picks and chooses. It judges. But you know, many of you have friends that other people may not like as much as you like them. Right? Did you ever think about that? Many of you may have good friends that other people may not like them. May not choose them as friends. Why not? The other people might think your best friend is obnoxious. Right? Why is that? Why is it that you don't see them that way? Because you're open to them. Because you accept them as they are. Because you don't judge them. That's why it's a good relationship. If you judge them, if you were critical of them, if you were always standoffish about certain things, if you didn't want good things to happen to them, if you wanted bad things to happen, that wouldn't be much of a friendship, would it?
You understand them.
And or if you don't understand them, you make an effort to understand them. Right? If there's somebody you care about, when they do something that bothers you, right? You might say to yourself, you know, I wonder why they did that, right? You might wonder. Or else, even if you didn't wonder, you might go, oh, I understand. You know, this is their childhood. These are things that happen. Or, you know, I can understand why they did it, right? So you extend understanding to them. Again, with people we love, really love, and people we're friends with, we do that naturally. Because, again, that is the naturalness of the heart. That is the heart that has not been contaminated with self. But it's so in the same ways that we have to free our minds from this overweening self-concern, self-centeredness, we have to free our hearts. And so the practice, coming back to where we started, the practice is both a practice of cultivating wisdom, which means cultivating mindfulness and concentration and insight and understanding, and cultivating on the heart side compassion, loving kindness. But, you know, even to say that, I've misspoken. Because there's really no such thing as the heart and the mind. They really are the same. We just talk that way. But there's no separation. The heart and mind are two words for the same thing. So when we practice both, when we practice these practices of compassion, when we practice these practices of insight and mindfulness, these really facilitate our transformation much quicker. than if we only concentrate on one side or the other side. And they need each other. The wisdom side can become a little cold or indifferent if we only practice the meditative side. We need to practice the compassion, loving kindness, empathic side, because that really gives us juice in our relationships. But on the other hand, if we're just practicing the compassion, loving kindness side, and there's no intelligence, there's no clarity, there's no wisdom, you know, we'll just be, it becomes sentimental, it becomes mushy, it becomes blind, you know what I mean? It's like cotton candy. There's no substance to it. A lot of people's good hearts have no substance. They're just kind of nice. But it's not a nice that has any wisdom or understanding or clarity. And it's often, again, contaminated by self. A lot of people are nice wanting everybody to know how nice they are. A lot of people are nice or good because that's the way they kind of get their ego strokes in this life. That's not a good reason. We're not here to build up ourselves. It's actually ourself which is constricting and twisting the natural goodness of our heart. In Buddhism we say, everyone has a natural good heart, like a puppy. Right? You don't have to train your puppy to be friendly. Right? Most people train their puppy not to be so friendly. Puppies are naturally friendly. Puppies are naturally happy, right? That's why people these days seem to like their pets more than they like people. You know, because, well, pets always what?
Unconditional
love. Always happy to see you, right? You could be the biggest jerk in the world, but you come home and your dog goes, he's home. The most wonderful person in all the world is home, right? I mean, who could resist that, right? I mean, that's cats don't do that, but dogs, they give you that unconditional, you are the most wonderful thing in the world. And what? And we love it, right? People love it. So we should learn from our pets about how to be open, loving human beings. So when we come back, I was going to do mindfulness is a source of happiness. I actually don't agree with this one, but I'll tell you why when we come back. Mindfulness is a source of happiness. Thank you.